Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 30th to April 6th. I'm joined this week by Father Leo O'Donovan, President Emeritus of Georgetown University. Welcome, Father.
Thanks, Tim.
Now, Father O'Donovan has an article in the current issue called Reading Karl Rahner, which offers some recommendations for those who are interested in dipping back into the works of the great theologian, or for beginners who are looking to explore his various writings. Now, Father O'Donovan, maybe you can start by just kind of placing Karl Rahner, a towering figure in 20th century theology, but for the beginner, maybe you can describe his impact on the world of Catholic theology.
One way to describe him, Tim, is as a great bridge between the dominantly neo-scholastic theology that he was educated in, dominated the church in the first 50 years of the 20th century, and the various movements that have been liberated in the later part of the 20th century, movements such as liberation theology, feminism, which would scarcely be thinkable without the contribution of Karl Rahner. Not that he was the only contributor, but are much more easily understood thanks to his theology. The council was prepared, as you, I'm sure you know, in many ways, by a great liturgical renewal that began in the first part of the 20th century, a renewal of patristic studies, a renewal of historical studies, and by significant developments in doctrinal and systematic theology, especially the new theology that developed in France. In Karl Rahner's case, he was especially concerned to take the skeptical mentality of the post-war era and meet it with the resources and riches of Christian thought. So I often think of him as predominantly a searching, questioning theologian, and people who had him in class comment often on how often he would begin by saying, "What are the questions we need to ask before we even begin to address this particular topic?" Let me give an example. In 1951, he wrote a famous article for the 1500th anniversary of the Council of Chalcedon, at which the most important single statement about Jesus being God and man had been proclaimed. Karl examined the teaching, but made a very important comment that this doctrine should not be considered so much an end of thinking about Christ and who he is for us, but rather a beginning. He held the doctrine to be fundamental to Catholic thought and to Christian thought in general. And in fact, you can trace the language of Chalcedon implicitly throughout his thinking. The doctrine states that Jesus is God and man inseparably and without confusion. That is to say, the Godhead and the humanity are not mixed and confused one with another. They remain distinct, but they are inseparable. And that plays into any number of other questions he deals with. As we tape this podcast, for example, the gospel for today is the gospel of the twofold command of love, which is in fact one command of love in the Gospel of Mark. I take the doctrine of Chalcedon to be a Christological statement of that twofold command. You cannot love God without being committed to the welfare of humanity. If you're committed to human welfare, you are in effect loving God. And the one figure in whom this is fully activated and present and assured as possible is Jesus, who gives us the two commands, in fact, as one.
The reason for this piece in the current issue is that we're marking the 25th anniversary of the passing of Karl Rahner. Research into his work continues today, as you point out in the article. There's still a lot of scholarship. There's a book coming out called Encounters with Karl Rahner, a book of essays by some of his German-speaking colleagues and friends. Now, you were one of among those who knew him. So you worked with him on your doctoral dissertation, is that correct?
That's right, Tim, in Münster, which is a wonderful little university town in northwest Germany. I first heard him speak. I didn't meet him then, but I heard him speak at a marvelous convention that Georgetown had at its 175th anniversary, and he gave there a paper on the theology of freedom, which affected me profoundly. It is one of his great pieces, I think. And I began to read more of him and finally decided that I would go to Münster to pursue my doctoral studies with him, which fortunately he accepted me doing. Münster was the perfect place to do it. He had, just before he went to Münster, been teaching in Munich, and I've often thought that if I had gone to work with him in Munich, I would have been very, very badly distracted by that wonderful city. But Münster is a little bit smaller, although it had at the time the biggest theological faculty in Germany, and it is again larger today. We were about 20 doctoral students. He attracted people from all over the world, of course. There were Frenchmen and Belgians and French Canadians, and there was a Japanese fellow doctoral student, German doctoral students, of course. At that time in Münster, Johannes Baptist Metz was also teaching and attracted a great many very talented theologians to study with him. Walter Kasper was at the very beginning of his brilliant career at the time. He turned out to be, I'm very grateful for this, my second reader. Erwin Iserlo, who was a famous student of Lutheranism, was teaching church history. In the Protestant faculty, there was a great New Testament scholar named Willy Markson. It was a very stirring time in Münster, and there were other faculty members I'm not mentioning, but it was a thrilling time to be there, and it was, of course, in the years immediately after the council. So we were all, I would say, unrealistically hopeful, but thank God, very, very hopeful about our church and its future.
Now that was the beginning of your relationship. You started off as a student, but you developed a more a closer personal relationship over the years. Now, most people are familiar with Ronner just from his writings. Maybe you can kind of describe the man. As you were saying earlier, he was not a particularly formal man, as you described.
That's right. His brother Hugo, a great patristic scholar, a student of the early church fathers, the great early writers in the Christian church. Hugo was 4 years older. Hugo was taller and more stately and, one could say, more elegant. He was elected president, a rector, rather, of the university in Freiburg, in Innsbruck. You wouldn't expect Karl to be considered for that office. He was a little grumpy, a little frumpy, a little tousled. His pants were never long enough. The last great, great assistant he had, Frau Elfriede Oegel in in Innsbruck, said to me once, he will never get over those Hochwasserhose, which means those high water pants. He had a wonderful sense of humor, and in ordinary conversation, he could be incredibly witty, down-to-earth, plain-spoken. He had really something of the peasant to him. There are not a few pictures that reveal Karl in a skeptical, even melancholy, almost depressive mood. He took the questions of the modern world about its meaning, its purpose, where it was going, terribly seriously. I think he shared the anguish of people before the question of death. It was almost impossible for him to receive a request from a student, a former student, somebody who had just read one of his books. If somebody wrote to ask him a question or asked for help, he would often by hand, but in one way or another, respond to almost every query he received. He was also indefatigable at work, and you have to remember that in the very end of the 30s, when he began teaching through the 40s and into the 50s, men teaching at a place like the faculty in Innsbruck worked on a typewriter and had very little secretarial help, had to type out all their notes. And, of course, he taught in Latin in those days. He spoke brilliant Latin. It's often said that, it's not true, but it's often said that his Latin was better than his German. He was given the Sigmund Freud Prize for German writing at one point later in his life. And there's also the canard, of course, that Hugo was repeatedly asked when he was going to translate his brother's theology into German. He was helpless, before a request for help. And this was especially true, I would say, with regard to the church's welfare. At the council at which he was first, from which he was first excluded, but then taken by Cardinal Koenig as his personal expert, I've been told repeatedly by people like Cardinal Lehmann that he worked so hard, working on texts, giving conferences for bishops, other theologians, correspondents at the council, that he truly endangered his health. He was not a man who paid a lot of attention to his health, and indeed he died, as you mentioned earlier, 25 years ago today at the age of 80, which is a full enough life, but not a very long life by many of today's standards.
Now, in your piece, you offer five guiding questions for people who are approaching the work of Karl Rahner. Now, maybe many of our listeners have not read any of his works. What advice would you offer to them getting started?
Well, let me answer that in two parts, Tim. First, what should somebody read first by Karl Rahner? And secondly, a few things to look for that I've talked about in my little piece and have written about at greater length elsewhere. I often suggest to people that they would do well first to read Karl Rahner's prayers or meditations. And I have always on my shelf to give to somebody who's interested a copy of his wonderful little book from the late 30s, Encounters with Silence. It's a series of 10 meditations originally printed in the newspaper in Innsbruck, beautifully translated by a deceased Jesuit named James Dembski. And in those meditations, one finds not only the bearing of a soul and profound faith, but many of the fundamental perspectives, the viewpoints that undergird his theology for the next almost 50 years. Some people say the philosophical framework. I don't think of it that way because I don't think of him primarily as a philosopher, but a theologian who makes use of philosophical notions to present the faith more credibly to today's human beings. Another wonderful book that he wrote directly after the war is a series of conferences he gave in a church in Munich. He could not hold them in the cathedral, which had been expected or would have been hoped for, because the cathedral was completely destroyed by the bombing of the city at the end of the war. So was the great church, St. Michael's of the Jesuits, but he gave it in another church. They're marvelous reflections, and in there there's a famous little essay called "The Value of on the Possibility of Intercessory Prayer." He once told me that he had written nothing that he thought was any more important than that, because it in fact raises questions about our fundamental relationship with God, how God is active in the world, and the way in which God, as he firmly believed, cares wholly for us and our future. Later in his life, no longer obliged to hold classes, which for many decades had obliged him indeed full-time, he began to give more interviews. And some of those later volumes of interviews are very revealing and freer, less encumbered by the need to translate neo-scholasticism into a contemporary language. There's one essay in particular that he spoke of as his last will and testament that I would very strongly recommend. It's called "St. Ignatius Speaks to a Jesuit of Today," and it's deeply stirring. If someone reads that, the person will see why I say that he contributed a great deal to liberation theology, which he very much admired. Just a word about five things to look for as you read Rahner, wherever you start, and whether you're a beginner, whether you're going back to more spiritual writings that you find enriching, or whether you're studying the more systematic writings, which are very numerous, to say the least. Look, first of all, for how he understands human thinking and human reason, and notice that he prizes that aspect of our thought which is not technical, the aspect of human thought which is appreciative, let us say, and for which experiences like love and trust and commitment, justice, are primary experiences and terms that one can never fully define or control. closely connected with that, pay attention to the relationship between our thinking and our freedom. Carl thought, in fact, that human reason really fulfills itself only when we freely become loving human beings. He was not anti-rational by any means, but he thought that love fulfilled itself only, pardon me, that reason fulfilled itself only in love. For that reason, he was a person committed to practice as a key issue in life, the key issue, in fact. And he began his thinking with how the church believed and lived, rather than with a theory about the church. From the beginning, he was interested in people's finding God and living with the Son of God, lives that were self-sacrificing and hopeful. A fourth thing to look for is his understanding the relationship between the individual, the community, and God. He's often presented as an individualist, somebody who talked all the time about personal experience, singly, me vis-a-vis God. But if you take his thought as a whole, you find that it's the community in which the individual alone can become oneself that is primary, and the community as coming from and called to God, not as separate from God. His thought does not begin with a question philosophically that moves to a theological answer, in my viewpoint. His thought begins always in grace, looking to let that grace envelop one's life more fully. The archetype for that experience, in my view, are the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. It's been commonly said for 20 years now that the spirituality of St. Ignatius greatly influenced Carl, and that's certainly true. And he said that repeatedly in his later years. But the point I would like to make is that it's not just the spirituality in general, it's the spirituality of the exercises which move incrementally, in a technical term, dialectically through stages, so that you ask questions in each week. You have experiences in each of the 4 weeks of the exercises which build on each other. And until you have some sort of an answer in the first week, how has God blessed me despite my sinfulness, you can't move to the second week, which asks, what was the life of Christ like and why would I want to follow it? And if you don't pose that question and come to some answer about it, which you're given, of course, you cannot then follow Christ to his passion. It's not just that he was born and then went to the cross. He was born into a ministry which brought him to his passion, and similarly with the resurrection. So my point is, look for the way in which the spirituality has interrelated moments, a dialectic, I would say, in technical terms, that you as a reader and we as a community can follow. The German word is nachahmen, follow or imitate or do after, share with him. I think you'll find reading him that you're drawn in again and again into the experience he's reflecting on, and you'll be graced by that experience.
Now maybe we can circle back and end with some more memories of the man. Now, you spent some time with him just before he passed away in 1984, in fact, on Ash Wednesday. Maybe you can describe a couple of us, or give us a couple stories from that time you spent.
Sure. I had been up to see him right after the 33rd General Congregation of the Jesuits in 1983, when Father Peter Hans Kovenbach was elected general. And really, I should tell you this story. I called him immediately after the election to tell him who had been elected general. I was in Rome and he was in Innsbruck. And you'd expect this great theologian to say, well, will he be able to manage our situation? Or do you think he has the political savvy for dealing with the Vatican Curia? Or has he been in the Middle East too long? Or some sort of a technical question. But the question he put to me about the newly elected general of the Jesuits was simply, is der nett? Which means, is he nice? So I went up to Innsbruck to tell him that he was very nice indeed and also had the savvy and also had not been too long in the Middle East but had learned a great deal from it. And we walked through the early November snows And as a result, I went back in March for his 80th birthday, which the city of Innsbruck really celebrated. On the next day, which was Ash Wednesday, we took a trip that I described briefly in my little piece. I don't describe how I drove because I never drove fast enough for him. He loved to drive fast. In fact, at one point in the snow, trying to accede to his wishes, I frankly drove off the road into the gully, which infuriated him. And I said to him, well, it was your fault. You told me to drive faster. We got out of the ditch and went off to dinner. And I tell the story, and perhaps this would be a good way to close. My last meal with him, which I, of course, cherish, we went to a famous restaurant in the foothills of the Alps outside Innsbruck. And as we arrived, he was a little bit daunted by going to a dinner on Ash Wednesday. And I said, well, at 80, you don't have to worry about that. And I'm traveling. And the proprietress was outside welcoming us, and she welcomed him as though he were the Kaiser reborn. And anybody with him was a terribly important person. He said, you go ahead and order first. And then I realized why he said that, because all he ordered was this awful, huge dessert of palatschinken, which is a kind of pancake made with apples. He loved dessert. And that's the last thing I remember eating with him.
Well, that's a nice way to end. Again, the article is Reading Karl Rahner, which appears in our March 30th through April 6th issue. We want to thank Father O'Donovan for coming by.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Good to be here.
I want to thank you for joining us for the American Magazine podcast. A reminder that you can now access our podcast by simply going to our homepage, americanmagazine.org, scrolling down, and just hit play. You can also respond to our conversations by going to americanmagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for American Magazine.